Hello and welcome to Worstwood Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxtay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. Order, 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 please, order. So that's the vegetable soup, an egg mayonnaise, a chicken curry, and a steak medium rare. Thank you, excellent. My colleague will be along shortly to take your wine. Order! And alongside me is the most honourable member I know, Ben Vandeveld.
Thank you very much, the member for Dublin. I mean, that sounds like a conversation from the mid-19th century.
Kildare South is my constituency.
Kildare South, yeah, that's a bit where my brain went, oh shit, we don't own them anymore. Which I have to say is a very parliamentarian thing to say. There's something about watching the British House of Commons that I feel you probably don't get in many legislatures around the world, where you go, you guys still think it's 1873. It's such an old gentleman's club. I remember Mari Black, who for non-British listeners is a 21-year-old gay Glaswegian that couldn't be further from your picture of a traditional British parliamentarian, saying that she walked in there and it was clearly a place designed not to be for the likes of you.
Yeah, anyone who's watched the proceedings in the House of Commons, it's like a mix of debate club and after dinner speeches. It's debate club, but everyone has had the wine and several brandies that you go with the after dinner speeches.
It also looks like the All Britain donkey impersonation competition.
Yeah. Having said that though, when you see a parliament from somewhere around the world where they're like, they have a brand spanking new parliament building and all of them, like, it's imitation oak podia and everything's like high tech and the building is shaped like a, you know, a beehive balanced on top of a Spanish galleon or whatever the architect has come up with. All of them like twisted metal and stuff. Then you go, this doesn't look like a parliament should look like. It looks too new. I don't trust it.
When I went to university and I was lucky enough to go to Oxford, one of the things I was really looking forward to was being in a room that was 250 years old and could imagine that Byron might have been there. And my whole staircase in the college was brand spanking new and looked like it could have been at any university in the world. It was like staying in a travel lodge. I was furious. Whereas my mate in university college had a desk that was 100 plus years old and had graffiti carved into it.
Oh, yeah. Do you want... I mean, maybe we can ask our guests, but I wonder if the MPs put their graffiti into the seats and the wood panelling in the House of Commons.
Oh, I bet they do. Well, it's... do you know what? That's a nice bit of the history. I was just thinking, any non-British person watching the proceedings at the British Houses of Parliament must be sat there watching it going, this is all well and good, but when's the sorting hat coming out?
Your House Hufflepuff, i.e. the Lib Dems.
Yeah. Oh, that is so on the nose. We should meet this week's guest, who is clearly more erudite and informed on such matters than us two idiots. Our guest this week is a journalist and a former actor. Not as useful as the other way round, which would mean you're able to write your own reviews. He currently works as a diarist and general news reporter for The Times, which is the UK's highest circulation broadsheet newspaper. In this role, he conducts interviews with dozens of politicians and public figures every year for The Times Diary, a short column of 6 or 7 daily anecdotes designed to brighten the reader's day. Obviously, in 2020, this has been shortened to 1 anecdote every 10 days. As an actor, he worked mainly in theatre, playing Romeo for Richmond's Orange Tree Theatre, while also running his own satirical blog and podcast entitled The Daily Satire. He now works extensively as a communications trainer, including running workshops at leading universities to improve public speaking skills of academics, with a particular focus on strategies for dealing with challenging questions about their work. With that in mind, we can look forward to grilling him about what it's like working for a Rupert Murdoch corporation alongside Giles Corran, and why the culture section of The Times has repeatedly refused to give this podcast a 6-page spread. It's the man with a name that makes him sound like a bodice-ripping hero from Mills and Boone, the swoonsome Jack Blackburn.
Hello. I'm just with your earlier point, I don't think there is any graffiti saying Winston Churchill was here.
Well, no, the only graffiti that Winston Churchill would put in would be about Nancy Astor.
What, as in core, what a scorcher.
Yeah.
That's exactly the response that would have been. Then again, the House of Commons chamber has only just recently celebrated 70 years since reopening, because it did get bombed to oblivion. So yeah. I've no doubt that before then it was absolutely covered in all manner of obscene. Were those little sort of compass spikes? That
yes.
Just
Or, well, I imagine, you know, no one ever says the second part of the speech that Chamberlain gave. I have in my hand a piece of paper. Someone has drawn a cock and balls in it. Who threw this at me?
I didn't realise that the Houses of Parliament were bombed by the Germans.
So the whole of that chamber that we're used to is completely new, by which I mean they rebuilt it exactly as it was, because that's what the British did.
It shows a lack of faith in the Luftwaffe on all of our parts that we wouldn't expect them to hit quite a very obvious building by the river.
Yeah, I think you're right, Barry. The Luftwaffe don't get enough credit.
In fairness to them, yeah, you couldn't say about the Luftwaffe they wouldn't hit an elephant with a banjo from 5 yards.
Like, hitting an elephant with a banjo sounds much more like the sort of thing the Special Operations Executive would do. You know, that's why the war took so long. The Luftwaffe were doing sensible warfare of dropping bombs on major targets, whereas we were off in this goon show parade trying to use musical instruments to hit wildlife.
The thing is, though, that elephant knew the location of Hitler's bunker. They were trying to beat it out of him.
Yeah.
It's already gone completely off the rails. Jack, when you're doing the diary or the, you know, any of the sketches, the parliamentary sketches and things like that, are you in the House of Commons? Are you just there watching proceedings, looking for like a funny instant, or like trying to catch an MP on the way past in the hallway to get a pithy quote? Or what's a day like that involve?
There's very limited access to House of Commons, so I'm afraid I'm not senior enough to get a pass. The passes are very hard to come by. I do go into Parliament in the evenings when they're holding social functions, and I go up and try and get them to say something funny or amusing. Main memories of this I can remember was the day when Chris Grayling, the Titan of the British politics.
For non-British listeners, all you need to know is that Chris Grayling's nickname is Failing Grayling.
Yeah. On this particular day, there had been a reshuffle, and he'd been appointed the chairman of the Conservative Party for a grand total of 36 seconds. It was quickly withdrawn, and I went up to go and sort of talk to him, and he gave me this sort of classic bluster about, I'm not going to ask that question. I will just say that I'm absolutely delighted to be in the briefing that I have got. I think it's the most exciting and interesting thing. It's the job I've always wanted. He was Secretary of State for Transport. He's that kind of level of charisma.
Yeah.
And then he went off, this is absolutely true, he went off with a load of other Tories in a corner, and they started talking about their second homes in France. It was as stereotypical as you could have wanted.
I imagine there are moments when you have to, it's very easy to write one of these caricatures because you're just surrounded by caricatures.
It's trying to find the people who are lesser spotted, the sort of the colourful characters. Mm. Some of whom you have to just accept that they are entertaining to a large section of the readership. We tried to do a broad spread. So every Thursday in the chamber, there's a thing called business questions where Jacob Rees-Mogg explains what is going to be coming up in the next week's business in the Commons. There's an entertaining tussle between him on the Tory benches and Chris Bryant. So just for those who are unaware, Jacob Rees-Mogg is an old Etonian, sounds like a drainpipe, very, very posh. He's always quoting poetry from the imperialist era. Across the aisle, Chris Bryant, a gay MP from the Welsh Rhondda region. Chris Bryant just sits there heckling him endlessly. And to be fair to Jacob Rees-Mogg, he gives as good as he gets. And for us, this is a very easy bit of copy, just to copy down.
Yeah. Half the time, I imagine, they will have grown up as like 8-year-old children reading the column that you're now writing for, going, someday I'm going to be giving my best to be in that column. They're playing to the gallery.
Absolutely. There's one Tory MP called Sir Desmond Swain, who dresses in these absolutely extraordinary grey suits. And he just sort of lies in the background, and it's just an invitation to be written about. He briefly had ministerial ambitions, but I think it's quite clearly decided that he wants to be remembered as a bit of a character. That's the approach that's been taken.
Please do look up pictures of Sir Desmond Swain, because he is a ripe slice of gammon for this podcast to talk about. He's a man who looks like he comes with his own pineapple on the side. And if you want to try and imagine him, then imagine a very disreputable second-hand vintage car salesman with delusions of mediocrity, and you're about there.
We've been to the Houses of Parliament. Any of our listeners want to go back into the archives? We recorded an episode with Tulip Sadiq MP, and we went to his Portcullis House, which is sort of the more slightly more modern building across the road from the House of Parliament, where a lot of the offices and meeting rooms are. And while we were waiting there with her assistant for her to come and meet us, just had the most banal experience of the leader of the Lib Dems at the time, Vince Cable, walking by holding a sandwich.
Portcullis House is essentially a glorified Pret a Manger, doesn't it?
Jack, we always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. Clearly, you're very good at winkling out a pithy anecdote. What are you not so good at?
I had to consult my fiance about this, and when she said this, I realised that she was entirely correct. I am the worst person in the world at being able to see the thing I am looking for. There's a big old spray of bright orange liquid used for cleaning, and I can never see it. I will have emptied entire cupboards. I will have demanded explanations as to its whereabouts, and then my fiance will point on the kitchen counter where I am standing right next to it. I have this complete blindness. I did hear this as a hint, and it does work. If you say the name of the thing you're looking for, it will suddenly appear in front of you.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. So I will go cleaning spray or keys. and it comes out. I'm also terrible at cleaning.
There it is.
I claim this is a disability of mine rather than active sloth.
active sloth is the most disappointing. It's the most disappointing cleaning product on the market. Also, finding about what you're worst at in the world, it's a delight to welcome Bono's muse onto the podcast for the first time.
He still hasn't found what he's looking for, is that what you mean? Yeah.
That's what I was going for, yeah.
He also lives on a street with no name, oddly enough. This week, we are going to make use of Jack's insider knowledge to talk about the world's worst parliamentarian. Now, I know Jack and I have both looked to the UK, but I think Ben is taking us on a little trip further afield for some of his suggestions. So, Ben, launch into your maiden speech.
Thank you very much, Speaker. To begin with, we are going to start in the United Kingdom, and we are going to go to the year 1803, and we're going to talk about the Gatton by-election. I don't know if this term exists outside the United Kingdom, but a by-election is essentially an election that takes place outside of a general election when a member of parliament either resigns or stands down or passes away and they need to elect a new one there. And Gatton is something that anyone who has familiarised themselves with Blackadder III will know about, because it was what is known as a rotten borough. And essentially a rotten borough is an electoral constituency which is corrupt, and the major landowner normally in that borough will be able to buy the votes to put who they want in place as the member of parliament for that seat. And there were dozens of these before the Great Reform Act of 1832, and probably a fair few afterwards. And the more you read about them, the more you think British democracy was a disgustingly corrupt practice, and indeed still is, but not to the extent that it was then. I'll tell you why the Gatton by-election is so entertaining. It was considered to be in the pocket of Lord of the Manor of Gatton, a gentleman called Sir Mark Wood. It had, at most, 7 voters, and all of these voters were tenants of Mark Wood. And in the 1802 general election, it returned Wood and his brother-in-law, James Dashwood. And they were part of William Pitt the Younger's faction of the Tory party. At Pitt's request, shortly after the election, Dashwood vacated his seat so as to make way for a gentleman called Philip Dundas. And it was considered that it would be a simple formality. He would return uncontested. This was complicated, however, when a barrister and reformer called Joseph Clayton Jennings turned up to contest the election. And not only that, he found someone who claimed to be entitled to vote in his favour. Real problem for Sir Mark Wood there. All of a sudden, he's got to get one of his seven electors out of bed to go and cast a vote for him. He was able to find a voter to come and vote for Dundas. Dashwood acted as the returning officer and rejected the ballot cast in favour of Jennings. And so Philip Dundas was elected with one vote. And my favourite thing is, if you look on Wikipedia, the breakdown of it is, it has the two candidates, Philip Dundas, Tory party, Joseph Clayton Jennings, party unclear. Votes won. Majority won 100%. Turnout won, that is 14%. And brilliantly, it is then listed as a Tory hold with a zero swing.
Also, I like the idea at the next election, if they were looking at target seats, this place with a majority of one would come bottom of the target because he had 100% of the vote.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yes, of course. And that one, I couldn't help looking at the people who had received the least votes in an election, and I found a fascinating figure called Lieutenant Commander William George Bokes. Now, Billy Bokes was a genuinely impressive man of the military. He entered the Navy in 1920 as a boy seaman, and he was part of the Dunkirk evacuation in May 1940. He was on board HMS Basilisk, which was sunk, but he helped with the evacuation, and he also took part in the sinking of the Bismarck while serving as a gunnery officer. And after the war, he decided to take part in the 1951 general election, and he contested Walthamstow East as an independent candidate for Admiral, which stood for the Association of Democratic Monarchists Representing All Women.
Weird spelling of Admiral. He could have said all ladies.
Oh, he could, couldn't he?
Yes!
Well, listen, as we're going to discover over the next couple of minutes, I think his entire electoral career was a rather spectacular example of PTSD.
Okay.
He stood on a platform of equal pay for women, subsidised apprenticeships and the sale of council houses. So a very sort of bold mixture of socialism and Thatcherism there. And he had intended to stand against Prime Minister Clement Attlee. However, he stood in the wrong constituency, because Attlee's constituency was Walthamstow West. This really underlines the sort of candidate that Bokes was. He received 174 votes, finishing in last place with 0.4% of the vote. He then became obsessed with road safety. And I suppose in the 1950s, that was a fairly large and important issue. There's a lot of things that we just take for granted nowadays, don't we? But at first, he used his Vauxhall car, which he named Josephine, and painted it as a zebra crossing, complete with loudspeakers and placards all across it. And he would...
Did he find the Beatles then just kept walking over the car?
Yeah.
Just going to attract pedestrians.
Yes.
Terrible to race safety.
But did he paint them running up from the front of the car to the back, or from one side to the other? Because if it's front to back, that is a complete death trap.
It really is. It's basically, he's trying to, the equivalent of wanting to promote safety for moths and going around dressed as a light bulb.
But also, did he call it Admiral Insurance? Because that's a missed opportunity if he didn't.
Oh, God, it really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
This gets better. In later campaigns, owing to a lack of money, he replaced the Vauxhall with a £140 armoured bicycle which concealed an iron bedstead.
Wow! Would that be following the pedestrian car? So the person who'd be knocked down would then at least have a hospital bed to be laying into with the bike behind.
Either that, or because his running mate was Angela Lansbury. The armoured bicycle included a camera for taking photographs of motorists breaking the law and featured an 8-foot flagpole with sloganeering banners. The bike was eventually hijacked and taken to Aberystwyth. I don't know why.
This is truly the Kanye West of post-war presidential campaign.
Yes. He continued with this sort of nonsense on the 2nd of April 1955, before the start of an England versus Scotland match at Wembley Stadium. Boak stopped his van outside and refused to move until all the spectators had crossed the road in front of it. 2 hours later, he stopped his car at a roundabout on Cambridge Circus, which is in central London, again refusing to move until pedestrians crossed. He's like a very forceful rogue lollipop man.
So he's got a car painted with pedestrian crossings. He's got an armoured bicycle. Presumably the van contains a 2 weeks holiday in the Maldives or something in it. It's like some sort of Transformers contraption.
Well, it's either that or he's playing a game of real life Monopoly. The next thing he turns up and was going to be a Scotty dog wearing a top hat. He, after all this nonsense, he stood in the 1956 by-election, this time in Walthamstow West. He's got it right, and he finished in last place with 89 votes.
Oh, he'd lost some people.
Just as a side note, in July 1959, he entered the annual Bleriot race to travel from Marble Arch in London to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris by any form of transport he chooses.
Because he had all of the forms of transport.
He did, but he eschewed all the ones I've told you about, and he chose to enter the race by roller skate.
How did that go with the channel?
Surely he was just stood at Dover going, any minute now it's going to freeze.
I can't understand why the people of Walthamstow East nor West didn't want to elect him as their public representative.
In 1976, or in between the 47th and 48th Parliaments of the United Kingdom, he contested 18 by-elections.
Oh, God.
He never campaigned in the constituency. He would turn up to the constituency, secure the 10 names required to be nominated as a candidate, and then never campaign.
That is amazing.
And my favourite moment was in 1982 at the Glasgow Hillhead by-election, where, having gathered the 10 names required to be nominated as a candidate, he then received 5 votes. That was a record that remained unbroken until the 2005 general election, when Catherine Taylor-Dawson of the Vote for Yourself Rainbow Dream ticket received 1 vote in Cardiff North.
At least she took her own party's advice there.
Yes.
Presumably.
So we assume, yeah.
But actually, it's a terrible idea. That's why she only got 1 vote. Everyone in the constituency voted for themselves. It was a complete tie.
Yeah. He was Billy Boak's rather revolutionary in his way, because he acted as the counting agent for Screaming Lord Such.
I was about to say, he's like a one-man, we've talked about them before, the Monster Raving Loony Party.
Yeah, he did. And he was sort of, a progenitor of them in many ways. I suppose you could say he was the Lonnie Donegan to Screaming Lord Such as Lennon and McCartney. And his overall record in elections, he never received more than 0.5% of the vote, meaning he lost all his £150 deposits. And in his political career, he lost over £4,200 in deposits.
Wow.
And he has a rather bittersweet end to his story. So throughout his life, Billy Boak campaigned for road safety. And in 1982, he received head injuries in a road accident after he got off a bus at the wrong time. And they eventually led to his death a couple of years later. So, a sad end to quite the eccentric.
Yeah.
We're now going to just pop over to Germany before my actual nomination. And I'd like to tell you about Jakob Maria Mierscheid. Have either of you gentlemen heard of him?
No.
So, he was born on the 1st of March 1933. And the official biography of the German Parliament lists him as a member of the Trade Union of Peasants and Lumberjacks.
Can I just say, it's such a relief to hear he was born in 1933 and we're not talking about a Nazi for once on this programme.
Yes.
unless he was elected to the Reichstag at the age of 6.
Baby Nazi.
He was the original Hitler Youth.
There is no Nazism involved in the making of this anecdote.
Sorry for besmirching the name of this guy, by the way.
As you're going to find out in a moment, Barry, it honestly doesn't matter. He was a member of the Sports Friends Club, is the treasurer and honorary member of the Choral Society of the Trade Union for Wooden Plastics Workers. In 1967-68, he wrote a 4-part series about the travel routes of the ring-tailed wood pigeon and its avionics. And he was also a writer in the Central Journal of Carrier Pigeon Breeder Association Weekly, reprinted in 1969. He entered Parliament in 79, and he acted as the deputy chairman of the Mittelstand Sauskus, the Committee for Small and Medium-Sized Businesses. And he worked doing various backbench work in the Bundestag for 25 years. He eventually left Parliament in 2005. Such was his contribution to Parliament that when the new Parliament was moved to Berlin, two new office buildings were connected by a bridge that was named after him, the Meerscheid Bridge, which is quite a thing for him. And it's quite hard to find him really contributing too much to German political life. And the reason for that is Jakob Maria Meerscheid doesn't exist.
What?
I'm having a great deal of trouble really understanding what's happening here, other than a really strange German joke. But he has a seat in Parliament. He is always listed as a member of Parliament. He is listed as giving speeches, as attending committees, but he is a phantom. He does not exist.
The Phantom of the German Parliament is a really failed West End musical idea.
Yes, and also the original Nazi plot before the Reichstag part fire.
Who burnt it down is probably the Phantom.
Yeah. Another member of Parliament, Friedhelm Wollner, who does exist, says, many of us hide behind a bit.
Sorry, I know you don't have to clarify that. Someone you're quoting.
I don't know. I think now we do need a lot of clarification.
But it just seems to be one of those things that someone invented for a laugh in the 70s, and now the guy has a fake picture of himself and a fake history. And in his hometown of Moorbach in 2013, to celebrate his 80th birthday, they opened a hiking trail, which is a round trip of 10 miles, providing humorous reflections on his life and political activities.
Is this how Donald Trump is going to evade his forthcoming legal difficulties? He's going to get out of it. We're all going to be convinced that there was a president, Donald Trump, but he never existed.
Yeah, never existed.
No, Donald Trump hasn't been the president around here for 50 years. But I couldn't find any other real explanations about him online other than it's just Germany's wacky sense of humour.
I swear to God, listeners, if one of you doesn't set up a Gmail account with his name and email us afterwards saying, I do exist, and punk the shit out of us, I'll be so disappointed. He's our 60th Patreon donor. Yeah.
But for my worlds was parliamentarian, I'm going to go back to the Georgian era and talk about John Mad Jack Mitten.
And that name inspires so much confidence in the electorate.
Yeah, yes. I'm not sure that it was written on the voting slip. His family were Shropshire squires with a lineage going back some 500 years in the area. And when his father died at the age of 30, Jack was just 2 years old, and he inherited the family seat of Holston Hall near Oswestry. And that was worth more than 60 grand at the time, £4.3 million as of 2006. He was sent to Westminster School, but expelled after 1 year because he fought with a master. He was then sent to Harrow, from which he was also expelled after 3 terms. He was then educated by a variety of private tutors who he would torment with practical jokes, such as leaving a horse in one of the tutors' bedrooms.
The full horse. Not, he didn't go mafia style, just the head. The whole thing.
No, no. Just of all, how he got them up the staircase, who knows, unless he used a hoist to get it in via the window. He was granted entry to Trinity College, Cambridge in 1816, and he allegedly took with him 2,000 bottles of port to sustain himself.
Is that just for the first year or for the full undergrad? Yeah.
That was just for Freshers Week.
Yeah.
He was not awarded a degree, and after university life, he embarked on a grand tour of Europe. He entered the army. You'll be unsurprised to know he fell into disrepute through gambling. He indulged particularly in a love of horse racing and gambling, and in 1825 he bought a horse named Euphrates and entered it into the Gold Cup at Lichfield in 1825, which it won. Well done, Mad Jack. A year later, in order to win a bet, he rode a horse, I don't know if it was Euphrates or not, into the Bedford Hotel opposite the Town Hall in Leamington Spa, up the grand staircase, onto the balcony, from which he jumped, still seated on the horse, over the diners in the restaurant below, and then out through the window onto the parade.
Did he have a thing where he thought all bedrooms were stables?
Clearly he'd heard about Empress Catherine the Great and thought, oh, That's how you woo ladies. I'm going to tell you a few more horse stories. He loved hunting foxes. Obviously, he had his own pack of hounds. In fact, he had 2,000 dogs, which he kept.
One for each bottle of port. That's nice.
Precisely. Well, no, he fed them all steak and champagne.
Oh, no. Wow.
Yeah.
So he had fat, drunk hunting hounds.
Farting along on champagne bubbles behind him. His own favourite horse, Baronet, had the free range of Holston Hall and would often lay in front of the fire with Mad Jack.
In its own bedroom.
In its own bedroom. When he went hunting for foxes, he would usually do it in just a light jacket, thin shoes, linen trousers and silk stockings, and the thrill of the chase filled him up with such joy, he would often strip off his clothes and end up hunting naked, even in winter time.
Please tell me how this fine upstanding gentleman ended up in Parliament then.
We're getting there. It seemed that he genuinely loved accidents. He would often drive his gig, which is like the little carriage behind horses, at high speeds over toll gates to deliberately crash. And at one time he was with a passenger and he said to him, "Have you ever been overturned in a gig?" And his passenger said, "I have not." "What? What a damn slow fellow you must have been all your life." And he promptly deliberately drove the gig up a sloping bank at full speed, tipping himself and his passenger out of it. My last story about him is that in the 1830s, he had to flee to Calais, obviously with an attractive 20-year-old woman named Susan, to flee his debts. During his stay in Calais, he tried to cure his hiccups by setting his shirt on fire. A chronicler at this event, someone called Charles James Appleby, said that Mitten was said to exclaim, "Damn this hiccup," as he stood undressed on the floor. And in the act of getting into bed, he went, "I'll frighten it away." So he seized a lighted candle, applied it to the tail of his shirt, and was instantly enveloped in flames. And a fellow guest and Mitten's servant beat the flames out, and Mitten stood up and went, "The hiccup is gone, by God," and then got into bed naked and fell asleep.
This sounds very prescient of the UK government's response to coronavirus. Yeah. The smallest problem taken on with the most blunt instrument, and then whilst chaos raged, yeah, but at least the hiccup's gone. Like,
yeah.
So obviously this man was a blazing, drunk, braggart, gambler, hedonist. In 1819, he entertained ambitions of standing for Parliament as a Tory, following the family tradition. The way he secured his seat was by offering voters £10 notes.
Oh, great.
He spent a total of £10,000, or 750 grand in modern money, and became the MP for Shrewsbury. How long do you think he spent in the House of Commons, gentlemen?
Well, it's either going to be very, very long, or is it likely that it was about a day because his dad died and he inherited a title and had to go to the House of Lords?
Oh, that's a good idea.
I would love it to be that procedural, though. He spent 30 minutes in the House of Commons, but said he found the debates boring and difficult.
There were no horses and alcohol.
Right?
One of my favourites was Jeremy Thorpe, who recently had the sort of very successful television series made about him, you know, who tried to murder his ex-mother and ended up getting some hitman to shoot a dog.
Yes, but people who haven't seen it, it's a very English Scandal, I think, is this programme with Ben Whishaw and Hugh Grant.
And it's absolutely superb. I can remember watching that with my partner, and at the end of every episode, her looking at me with this sort of quizzical look at me going, "No, that all happened." One of my sort of favourites from the sort of more recent past was a Tory MP called Alan Clark, who's notable for writing some diaries that he has published. He is one of those characters who, were they in the 18th century, you'd go, "What a cove." But he was a minister in the Thatcher government, and it was only in the 80s. So a couple of good stories about him. One was that he had to present a bill, one of the first times he had to present a bill in the Commons. This is during the time where the House of Commons sat through the night, all night sittings. He decided that it was going to be a bit late by the time he was due up to chat. It was going to be quite boring to sit through and wait for this. So he decided to go to a wine tasting. When he stood up to deliver the bill, he was having some difficulty reading the speech in front of him. And Claire Short, who later became famous for resigning from Tony Blair's government over the Iraq War, she called a point of order. It's unparliamentary to suggest that another MP is drunk, so she started referring to him as incapable.
I have to say, that is the most British thing ever, that it's unparliamentary to suggest someone is drunk, but apparently not unparliamentary to be drunk.
You've got to keep the bars going.
Yeah.
the drinking is just everywhere.
How many bars are there in the Houses of Parliament?
There are 30.
Let it not be said that we don't have respect for our Anglo-Saxon heritage in this country.
So Alan Clark, going back to him, he was a noted womaniser. There was a scandal which broke after he'd left Parliament in the 90s when it was revealed that he had slept with the daughter of a South African judge, as well as her sister and their other sister and their mother. not at the same time. So he was a noted philanderer. But my absolute favourite story about him was he was driving down from London to his constituency in Plymouth one weekend. He broke the speed limit in the vague outskirts of London and was caught by a police car who switched their lights on and started suggesting that he might pull over. And he kept on driving, and he kept on driving, and he drove all the way down to Plymouth to his constituency home, got out, and was a bit surprised when the policeman stopped and got out of the car and came up to him and said, "I've been trying to get you to pull over for 3 hours, and I caught you doing 35 in a 30 area in southwest London. What the hell were you doing?" And Clark, who'd recently become a minister, said, "Oh, I thought you were my police escort." there was also something interesting in an absolutely scintillating magazine that I'm sure everybody reads called the Conservative History Journal, which I have to peruse for work.
I find it's very absorbent.
They've done a very interesting piece about Tories who represented seats in the so-called Red Wall. So these are the traditional Labour seats that the Tories won in last year's general election. And they've gone back and looked at the previous Tories who were there. Particularly pleased with the last Tory to represent Redcar, who gloried in the name of Wilf Proudfoot, described here as a larger-than-life grocer who built a chain of supermarkets and owned a pirate radio station. He only served for 5 years initially and lost, and then he found another seat and he served for another 4 years. So he had two terms in total. He kept on looking for a seat. His career comes to a sad end because he kept on pursuing things. And the profile says he lost 4 stone and had a facelift in a quest to find a safer seat, finally giving up and embarking on a new career as a hypnotherapist. So there was also in this the rather unsavoury people who used to serve for those seats for the Tories, including a man called William Ward, the Viscount Edenham. And he was one of these people who he ended up serving in the Commons for only 8 months because Daddy died and he succeeded to the earldom.
For non-British listeners, you're not allowed to be a member of the House of Commons and also a member of the titled aristocracy. They get booted upstairs to the House of Lords.
Yeah, you can only sit in one of the two. And you would naturally go to the Lords. I'm not sure he had much of a choice at this point, but he did go on to be a rather passionate speaker and a raging homophobe. when homosexuality was being legalised, he vigorously opposed the act, saying, "I cannot stand homosexuals. Prison is much too good a place for them. In fact, this is a place where many of them like to go, for obvious reasons." So an absolute bastard. But quite commonplace. Lords do provide some interesting people. There's a man called Bob Boothby. Viewers of The Crown will be vaguely aware of, because in the second series, when the Prime Minister is Harold Macmillan, you may recall that Harold Macmillan's wife is always on the phone chatting to a man, saying how brilliant he is, and how much he wants to leave Harold Macmillan, and how Harold Macmillan is nothing like this man. Mm. This is Bob Boothby. He had a long-standing affair with Dorothy Macmillan, the Prime Minister's wife. And that wasn't the only affair he had. He also supposedly had an affair with the East End gangster, Ronnie Cray.
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite some menage a trois.
Yeah.
This is disputed. It's not clear whether they did actually have an affair. But it is definitely true that Boothby would attend sex parties run by Cray, where, let's just say, the average age is not what it could have been. And this was suppressed because it was also in Labour's interest, because one of their MPs was going to it as well, a man called Tommy Dryburgh.
Yeah, Tom Dryburgh. Yeah. I vaguely remember Boothby being one of the very few people who actually came out and publicly said, I'm not a homosexual, at a time when people just basically didn't mention homosexuals unless they were, like, attacking them. He was one of those people who was subject to so many rumours that he said, I'm not homosexual. But I think he said something about how he thought everyone was a little bit bisexual.
He is the sort of thing, reading his profile now, you can see how people could have latched onto him as this sort of strangely progressive character.
Yeah. He was also a friend of the Llewellyn Davises, the children who inspired the Peter Pan books.
Yeah. I don't know if you can imagine this, but can you imagine a political character who, despite their numerous marital indiscretions and failures, manages to sort of get away with it with a sort of a bit of bravado and a joke?
Yes, I imagine that they would have a very successful career as a backbencher. You know, I can't imagine they would raise to any office higher than that, right?
Maybe run a small city somewhere, but no, sure. No more than that. Booby does have this famous story, which basically sort of managed to sort of gloss over the fact that he was having a chat in the 30s, and I'm terribly sorry about this, Barry, but with Hitler.
For fuck's sake, guys.
Booby got away with it because when he met Hitler, he walked into the room and Hitler stood up and said, Heil Hitler. And Booby just went, Heil Booby.
Sorry, I had no idea that Heil Hitler himself said Heil Hitler. That's the equivalent of the Queen singing God Save the Me. Honestly, it's like, you know, wondering and saying Hail Me is breathtakingly arrogant.
You really think Goebbels would have just nudged him and gone, I'm not sure it's the best look.
Yeah. Tone it down, Hitler, was never uttered by anybody in his inner circle.
So all of these people, they are all united by their self-interest, their carnal lust. There's also been hints of corruption about them. All of these, I think, reach their absolute pinnacle in my nominee for the worst parliamentarian ever, which is a man called John Stonehouse.
This is absolutely one of the best stories. And if anyone hasn't seen or read the play This House by James Graham, I heartily recommend that entire parliament, the 1974 to 79 British Parliament, which was a Labour government with a noticeably aging Labour party, where about 20 Labour MPs died over the course of the sitting. They ended up with a tiny majority. They were being forced to, like, lug in people on stretchers to get votes passed. And during this period, all three leaders of the major parties had changed during that period. And at one point, Big Ben stopped. And it's the time of, like, massive strikes and public discontent and all sorts of a really, really bizarre parliament. John Stonehouse is the most bizarre thing of all.
Yeah, he had been the Postmaster General in the last Labour government. He had stood up for the black community in what was then called Rhodesia. He was expelled from Rhodesia by the white government. So he had, you know, he had a lot of credentials. Until, so very sadly, on the 20th of November 1974... he was found to be missing, and then his clothes were discovered on a beach in Miami, and he walked into the sea. He was pronounced dead until a few months later when he turned up in Australia. So Stonehouse had faked his own death for a couple of reasons, one of which was one of his many business interests had gone significantly tits up, that he decided it would be a lot easier just to take a lot of money and run. The other reason was because he wanted to run off with his secretary, a woman called Sheila Buckley. So the plan worked perfectly. He'd actually got away to Australia with Buckley. Everybody thought he was dead. The Labour government, as Barry mentioned at this point, their majority fell to one after this happened. So they are absolutely shitting themselves about losing power. Stonehouse is broadly forgotten until a bank teller in Australia sees this man come in, who claims to be called Clive Mildune. Checks the money that the bank teller realises actually is in the name of somebody called Joe Markham. Thinks this is odd. Tall, English bloke, quite handsome, dodgy money going on. It's clearly Lord Lucan. Stonehouse actually sort of goes off for a jaunt in Denmark for a bit with his mistress. And when he comes back, he's apprehended by the Australian police, who think that they've caught Lord Lucan, who's wanted for the murder of his wife.
I think it was his nanny, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mustn't libel Lord Lucan, heaven forbid. Stonehouse is directed by the Australian authorities to drop his trousers. And this is true. The distinguishing mark of Lord Lucan is a 6-inch scar on his inner thigh.
That feels like it's fallen out of an Agatha Christie novel.
So he drops his trousers and they realise it's not Lord Lucan, but they sort of go, well, who are you then? At this point, he has an attack of conscience and he fills out a form which is to take on a job called the Steward of the Chiltern Hundreds, the Steward and Bailiff of the Chiltern Hundreds. These are one of two positions. The other one is the Manor of Northstead that an MP can apply to in order to resign because it's in the pay of the Crown. And you can't be an MP if you're being paid by the Queen. So he fills this out. He's going to resign his seat. He's going to go back and face the music. By the time he gets back, both he and, more importantly, the Labour Whip's office had a change of heart on this. The Labour Whip's office are delighted because their majority has just doubled. Stonehouse has also decided that he quite likes being an MP because it's quite a good protection against prosecution. So this goes on for a little bit until Stonehouse, in a fit of pique, because he doesn't quite understand why everybody's being so beastly to him, he joins the English National Party, and that is the moment when Labour did lose their majority. Uh-oh. So he pushes them over the edge. Eventually, he does leave Parliament. He is put on trial. He gets 7 years for fraud, and he's bankrupt. And then afterwards, he becomes a rather successful novelist. On his Wikipedia page, it has a delightful section entitled Actual Death. Just to be clear, he's dead and the story of John Stonehouse is over. Until we realise he is actually dead at this point. I must clarify, he's definitely dead.
John Stonehouse, who doesn't anymore exist.
It is then revealed that whilst he was in prison, it had been uncovered that since the mid-60s, John Stonehouse had been working as a spy for Czechoslovakia. It was decided by Margaret Thatcher's government that they probably didn't have enough evidence to secure a conviction, definitely. And they also thought that that was the threat had pretty much been nullified by him being in Wormwood Scrubs. Yeah. Telling the Czech slave acts what was going on for dinner. It wasn't necessarily a problem. As far as I can gather, the reason why Stonehouse did this was not because of any Marxist conviction, but because it earned him £5,000 in total. Obviously, £5,000 in the mid-60s, considerably more than it is now. But still, it's not vast amounts. And that is basically the story of John Stonehouse.
Wow, hell of a postscript.
He's one of those, just when you think his story couldn't get madder. When you go fake his own death. And I think in the lead up to his death, he was recorded doing an interview where he tried to appear mentally unstable, or may well have been, but he did like these interviews where he was talking about like seeing rivers of fire and things like that and death. Yeah. And stuff. So it was seemed to set up the faked suicide that then came along. And he thought, you're in Australia, you've gotten away with it.
The fake suicide was expertly carried out. In fact, the Joe Markram, the money it was, the name was actually in, rather than the second alias he picked for no apparent reason. Yeah. That was, he took that name because it was the dead husband of a constituent. He spent ages researching it.
God.
I kind of love it. Yeah.
Well, one of my least favourite current MPs is Dr. James Davies, the Conservative MP for the Vale of Clwyd, who, during the coronavirus pandemic, appeared at various parliaments around the world. I'm sure I do this where the Prime Minister faces questions from the opposition leaders and from members of their own party and stuff. And members of the own party tend to, you know, will the Prime Minister congratulate the Department of Health on their successful efforts in combating COVID and things like that? You know, set up nice, soft questions. James Davies asked the question during the midst of a global pandemic which has killed tens of thousands of people in Britain. He said, one positive among the gloom of the COVID pandemic is that this year's I'm a Celebrity will be filmed not in New South Wales, Australia, but in our own North Wales. Even if I cannot tempt the Prime Minister to take part in a Welsh Tucker trial, would he commend ITV on its choice of venue and welcome the positive impact this can have on the regional economy? I'm sure the constituents of the Vale of Clwyd were delighted that their MP took the time, at a time of national crisis and intense sadness, to ask the Prime Minister about the filming arrangements of a reality TV programme.
I think as a rule of thumb for the House of Commons, if the MP has the surname Davies, they are an enormous bell end. David Davies, I think there's two Philip Davies who are both as bad as each other.
Two David Davies.
That's the one, two David Davies.
Philip Davies is so widely disliked. Extraordinary.
And you mentioned Chris Bryant earlier on. Chris Bryant's quite a good author and writer as well, and has written a book about some scoundrels who've been members of Parliament down through history. And he wrote about a guy called Giles Mompesson, who lived from 1583 to 1663. He sat in the House of Commons for 7 years. He was officially a notorious criminal, it says here, whose career was based on speculation and corruption. He basically used his position to dispense licenses to innkeepers and took backhanders, and using his office to profit off it. He was so famous for his corruption that his name, Mompesson, was used as a symbol of all that was wrong and corrupt about the upper classes. And there's a character called Sir Giles Overreach, who's in a play called A New Way to Pay Old Debts by Philip Massinger from 1625. And that's based on Mompesson. He was so famously corrupt. But apparently his punishment that was issued against him when he was eventually brought to justice, and he had fled to France at this point, but he was issued a sentence in absentia, that he was to pay £10,000 in a fine. He would lose his knighthood and, according to Chris Bryant, walk down the Strand, a street in London, with his face in a horse's anus.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like something that Mad Jack Mitten would do for fun.
Yeah. Followed by life imprisonment. I have to say, other sources do suggest he just had to sit facing backwards on the horse, which is not quite as ignominious, but I prefer Chris Bryant's story, I have to say. I read about MPs who were sort of had certain famous things about, and you mentioned Mary Black, Scottish Nationalist MP. Mm-hmm. She was 20 years and 237 days old at the time of her election to the seat of Paisley in Renfrewshire South in 2015, the youngest Member of Parliament elected since the Reform Act of 1832. But there had been younger MPs prior to that. The youngest known person to have sat in the House of Commons was Christopher Monk, elected MP for Devon in 1667 at the age of...
12?
13. He sat for 3 years before being elevated to the House of Lords because his dad died. He is said to
for an apprenticeship, really.
Yeah, but what's even worse is that he was said to be moderately active during this period of membership, sitting on 7 committees.
Well, it got him out of Latin, didn't it?
Yeah. What a loss to the Commons he must have been when he was kicked upstairs. There are some cases of MPs who were elected posthumously. Edward Legg was elected unopposed as MP for Portsmouth in 1747, 4 days before the news arrived that he had died 3 months beforehand in the West Indies.
Wow.
And in 1780, John Kirkman was elected MP for the City of London, but had died just before the polls had closed. More recently, Thomas Higgins was MP for North Galway when Ireland still had contributed about 100 MPs to the House of Commons. He died in 1906 on the morning of the election. And in 1945, Sir Edward Taswell Campbell, Bromley, and Leslie Pym at Monmouth both died after polling had closed, but before the declaration of the results. The shortest non-posthumous service of an MP is that of Alfred Dobbs. Alfred Dobbs was declared elected for Smethwick in 1945 and was killed the day after in a car accident on the way to take his seat.
Oh no. And in 1945 as well.
Yeah, gotten through the war.
Got through all the war to get elected. Yeah. And then... dreadful.
Yeah, it's tragic. Malcolm Sinclair is an interesting case. He's a son of a Major General G.P. Sinclair, CB, CBE, DSO, educated at Eton College. He was in the Royal Armoured Corps. He was an officer in the Royal Scots. He served as Honorary Secretary to Winston Churchill. Landed gentry, good chap, well educated. He stood unsuccessfully as a Conservative candidate at London County Council elections, and in 1959 he stood as the Conservative candidate in Bristol South East, but lost the Labour Member of Parliament, Tony Benn, then known as Anthony Wedgwood Benn. But then the following year, Tony Benn's father died, and Tony Benn's father was Viscount Stansgate, a member of the House of Lords, and Tony Benn had an automatic seat in the House of Lords, which disqualified him from sitting in the House of Commons, triggering a by-election. Tony Benn wanted to stay in the House of Commons. Labour guy, socialist, thought he could get a lot more done, all of that stuff. So he wanted to resign his peerage, basically. He stood at the election defying the fact he'd been disqualified as an MP. And he and Sinclair were the only two people standing against each other in this by-election. Sinclair's campaign had posters near all the polling stations warning people that Tony Benn is disqualified. If you vote for him, it won't have any effect. But Benn won the election anyway. He had a majority of over 13,000 votes. But then an election court was convened and decided that Tony Benn was still disqualified, and voters, because of Sinclair's posters, were aware of this. And so they disqualified him again and gave the seat to Sinclair as the only qualified candidate. So he was elected to the Houses of Parliament without winning an election.
Wow. So how did Tony Benn get around being allowed into Parliament eventually?
An act was passed in 1963 called the Peerage Act, making a change in the law which said that basically people can disclaim their peerages. But Sinclair, at the time of this election, this by-election, was Master of Sinclair, heir presumptive to his cousin, Lord Sinclair's own seats in Scotland. He was also in line to be a member of the House of Lords. in fairness to him, Tony Benn was the first person to disclaim his own title on the day the law was passed. And Sinclair said he would respect the wishes of the people of Bristol if Tony Benn became eligible again, so immediately resigned his seat, taking the office of the Steward of the Manor of Northstead, which Jack mentioned earlier. Triggering another by-election, Sinclair didn't stand at it. There was no Tory or Liberal candidate, and Tony Benn was elected yet again. And one little interesting footnote, Sinclair was married to Rosalie Alice, daughter of Wing Commander C.L. Hargreaves, and granddaughter of Alice Liddell, Alice of Alice in Wonderland fame.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Can you, Jack will probably know this, can you name the MP who was married to the head of state of another country?
Stephen Kinnock.
Yes, the MP for Aberavon, Stephen Kinnock, since May 2015, is married to Helle Thorning-Schmidt, who is the former Prime Minister of Denmark.
Wow.
Which, I mean, we're not at war with Denmark, but it does feel a bit like sleeping with the enemy.
It does a little. I mean, surely Stephen Kinnock, if he's had any marital difficulties, could stand and say, something is rotten in the House of Denmark.
Yeah.
Ill-advised chat-up line.
Yeah. And there are cases of members of Parliament being married to each other. There's members of Parliament who have divorced each other. And there are parents and children. Tony Benn's son, Hilary Benn, was later elected, and they sat in Parliament together. Harold Macmillan, Stanley Baldwin, Winston Churchill, Ramsay MacDonald, all former Prime Ministers whose children were in Parliament with them. Daniel O'Connell, the Irish great reformer, was MP from 1828 to 1846, and his sons, John, Morris and Morgan, were all elected alongside him in the 1832 general election, which is maybe the greatest number of parent and children all returned at the same election.
I mean, that needs to be renamed the Brady Bunch election.
Yeah, it really does. But I've gone to the world of deaths to find my worst MP. On Wikipedia, you can go and find a list of MPs who died while sitting MPs, and there's lots of people falling off horses, some of them while drunk, and there's lots of drownings and people on sinking ships and all of the stuff you would expect back in the past of, you know, fairly wealthy people who had estates and were travelled a lot. Sir Ralph Carmino died when he was pulled over a cliff by his hounds when out hunting. Perhaps they were the drunken hounds of this guy Mitten. Yeah, drunk on champagne. Sir Oliver Cromwell, the uncle of the Oliver Cromwell that we all know and love, died after falling into the burning hearth while drying himself after being caught out in the rain. There's a few accidental gunshots, including Richard Barry, the 7th Earl of Barrymore, who accidentally shot himself while escorting French prisoners of war. And Mr. Charles Lennox, who was the MP for Richmond and Gordon, died in 1819 of rabies from a fox bite. Which shouldn't be that funny, but somehow is. We've mentioned on the show before William Huskisson, who was the MP for Liverpool, who died when he was hit by the Rocket, Stevenson's train, on its first day of operation. Robert Alien B. Slaney, he was a Liberal MP for Shrewsbury. He died after a fall at the opening day of the London International Exhibition. You know, occasionally you'll see these videos like an MP or a candidate will fall off a stage while giving a speech or walking off. He did that. He fell through a gap in a platform and got a wound on his leg. Continued walking around the exhibition, but the wound turned gangrenous and he died a few days later.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And James Tomkinson, a Liberal MP for Crewe, he died in 1910 after a fall from a horse during the House of Commons steeplechase. which apparently was a thing back in the past.
They still do the odd thing now. It's usually the pancake race.
Yes, yeah.
That's now an annual thing.
There's fewer of them own racehorses nowadays than did back in the 1890s and 1900s. I just read briefly about it. There was the 1889 running of the House of Commons steeplechase was won by an MP called Flowers, who was a liberal, who renamed his horse Home Rule as a little dig. He was an advocate of Irish Home Rule against the Tories. But he was disqualified because it was later discovered the horse had run competitively before, which was against the rules.
That feels like there's an allegory in there somewhere for the way British-Irish politics played out for the next century.
But I found a curious pair, one of whom is my choice, MPs who were killed by turnips. In 1833, the Whig MP for Huddersfield, Lewis Fenton, fell from the upper windows of his home at Spring Grove, landing in the courtyard below, and died from his injuries. And press reports suggested there was considerable mystery, was the term they used, which maybe hinted at suicide. But the inquest later returned a verdict of accidental death. His wife explained to the surgeon who looked after him he had been in the habit of going up into the attic to try and get a view of a piece of ground where some turnips were growing to see that none of his cows were trespassing in it. And he had stood on a chair to look out of the window and had fallen out. But he's not even the best death by turnip. Because in December 1881, the former Conservative MP for Thirsk, Sir William Payne Galway, died while out shooting on his estate at Thirkleby Park. There are a few MPs who died while out hunting. James Platt, the Liberal MP for Oldham, had died. He accidentally shot himself. And there are various other MPs who died while hunting because someone else had accidentally shot them. The Dick Cheney excuse. Galway, however, didn't die by gunshot wound. No, the Northern Echo reported that he was out shooting in the parish of Bagby and, in crossing a turnip field, fell with his body onto a turnip, sustaining severe internal injuries.
I love that this entire show is just a homage to Blackadder the Third. Ended it beautifully.
S. Baldrick isn't even the worst turnip owner in Parliament.
The thing is, he wasn't even that good at MP as well. The Northern Echo in this article observed that although this man Galway has heard the burning words of Mr. Gladstone, the polished satire of Mr. Disraeli, the sustained eloquence of John Bright, and the incisive epigrams of Mr. Lowe, he has never acquired the art of public speaking. So, for an MP who witnessed some of the great parliamentarians of the Victorian age and didn't try to match them in any way, shape or form, to then die at the not even the hands of a turnip.
Presumably there must have been some backbencher who put in a private member's bill about turnip control or something. The scourge of turnip deaths. We've seen a 200-fold rise in turnip
So our candidates this week for the world's worst parliamentarian are Ben's suggestion of John Bad Jack Mitten, the MP for Shrewsbury, horse lover, speech hater. Jack's suggestion of John Stonehouse, the man who walked into the sea and in Miami and appeared around the other side of the world in Australia. And my suggestion of Sir William Payne Galway, the second in the line of deaths at the hands of the turnip killer. excellent work all round. I love John Stonehouse's story. It's one that really, it's a fascinating story, and I love how William Payne Galway died, but John Bad Jack Mitten, with his horses and drunk hunting hounds and all of, he's got so much. It's like the two of us have brought forward two very able presidential candidates, and they have come up against Barack Obama. He is the Barack Obama of bad parliamentarians. So congratulations, Ben and John, Bad Jack Mitten.
Yeah, Barack Obama hammered on port on top of a horse in front of the fire.
Before we go, we would normally be bringing you some of the best news of the week, as we've been doing this year in the wake of the pandemic, to try and, you know, cheer things up. But for 1 week only, I am returning to some of the worst news of the week, because, Ben, we have a sequel to some news we had a couple of weeks ago.
Oh no.
During our episode with Juliet Myers about the old wives' tales a couple of weeks ago, Ben brought us the marvellous story of Sven Kirby, a man in Yorkshire who adopted during lockdown two geese to keep him company. The geese called Norbert and Beep Beep. who would take them to the pub with him, and he was told he could do so long as he made them wear nappies. But now, news has broken that 34-year-old Sven has been told by his local council that the birds are making too much noise for his neighbours, and he must prevent the recurrence of the nuisance within 28 days or face a fine of up to £5,000. Sven says, "I love my geese, whose names, I will remind you, are Norbert and Beep Beep. They're brilliant characters and great fun to keep as pets. The prospect of losing them is heartbreaking. It almost feels as if social services are taking my children away. Norbert and Beep Beep do see me as their father or mother."
It does seem a bit dark to say you must make your geese be quiet within 28 days, a month before Christmas.
I'll be honest, that does feel like a long-form task set by Alex Horn.
"I'm sure that if they will have to go, then they will suffer separation anxiety," says Sven. It's really sad. Leeds City Council spokeswoman has said, "We take any issue regarding noise nuisance in our communities extremely seriously and would always investigate any complaints that are made." So, I don't know, we have a platform, Ben. A small platform it may be, but a platform nonetheless. And I feel 2020 has had enough tragedy. This is the line we draw in the sand. This is the hill that we die on. This is the downy hill that we make our stand on. And listeners, you may have better things to do with your day, but if Leeds City Council does have a Twitter account or a complaints email address, I'm sure a quick Google will help you find it. And maybe, just maybe, in the wake of Margaret Rashford's successful campaign to feed starving school children, this is the next great campaign that the nation will rally around. Sven Kirby must be allowed to keep his geese, whose names, I remind you again, are Norbert and Beep Beep. Before we go, Jack, and where can people read you and follow you and all of that stuff?
I'm at Hack Blackburn on Twitter, and you can read me in the Times. Please buy a paper.
Or hack their firewall.
Listen, do not hack the firewall, please.
Meanwhile, we're all off to feast on champagne and turnips. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.